sitting on my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
And protection.
Fairness.
Fair trial.
Citizens.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Losers.
News.
Men.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Focus.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
Responsibility.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sasktel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. I'm Jim Hutchings, and with me are my co-hosts, Daylene Sliz and Gord Barnes. And by telephone, we have our special guest, Craig Benjamin. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Craig, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, Craig. How are you doing today?
Very good. Pleased to be on your show.
That's great.
Thanks so much for joining us from Ottawa, where things are a little more exciting these days with the new Trudeau government now fully installed. We have a full itinerary of discussion points today that will include the remarkable story behind Shannon's dream, the Jordan Principle, what the priorities should be now in terms of things like the Truth and Reconciliation Report, and the recent favorable ruling from the Human Rights Commission regarding funding of First Nations children's health and services and education. But before we dive into these issues, Craig, could you tell our listeners about your role and history with Amnesty International?
Sure. So I'm a member of staff, and as your listeners heard in the introduction, Amnesty is a worldwide movement. We're principally a movement of volunteers, of you know, ordinary people of all walks of life who put their time and their energy into standing up for the rights of others. Staff play a role of facilitating that activism, both direct support to membership and behind-the-scenes work where we do research and policy development to focus our energy on the kinds of changes that are needed. So, my work within Amnesty is as the campaign coordinator for our work in solidarity with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples within Canada, and also for our work around Indigenous Rights International. And I'm a non-Aboriginal person. I grew up in Nova Scotia, like a lot of people who are non-Aboriginal people grew up in Canada. I grew up knowing very little about the history of Indigenous peoples, very little about the history of the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. But I've had this, you know, incredible fortune over the years in a number of capacities before coming to Amnesty, of having the chance to work alongside some incredible Indigenous leadership from across Canada and around the world. I've had opportunities for learning that have just been phenomenal, and which have really motivated me and continue to really, you know, motivate me in this work day to day. But I, you know, do so kind of with this awareness that I'm on a learning path myself, and also awareness that that's the situation for so many of our activists and so many other people with a concern for these issues in Canada, that we have a lot of learning to do, and we need to you know, find ways to be effective allies in this work.
So, speaking of leadership and activists, if we could begin our discussion with Shannon's Dream, which is a national campaign ensuring that all First Nations children get a good education that respects their culture. Can you begin our discussion speaking about Shannon's Dream?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great beginning, because it is an opportunity to talk about two really phenomenal things. The first was a young woman from the Attawapiskat First Nation in Northern Ontario, Shannon Kustashian. And Shannon was going to school in a substandard school, and that's so often the case for so many First Nations youth, because of persistent year after year after year federal underfunding of on-reserve schools. And Shannon decided that she wouldn't stand for this. And she and other students in their school mobilized a campaign using YouTube and Facebook. And they brought this issue right to Parliament Hill. And Shannon was supported in this work by an extraordinary activist on the national scene, Dr. Cindy Blackstock, who is the founder of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. And out of this work that Shannon and the other students at Attawapiskat did, you know, two really powerful things came out. One was that, in fact, long last, in fact, a new school was built at Attawapiskat, and built, you know, not because of goodwill of the government, but because of the attention that was rallied. And the other is that Shannon inspired a national movement for safe, quality schools for all of the children in Canada, regardless of where they live, and certainly to overcome that long standing disadvantage faced by First Nations children. The tragic part of it is that Shannon, like so many other First Nations students, had to move away from home to complete her schooling. Part of traveling away to school, she was killed in a car accident in 2010. And so it's especially fitting that this campaign for First Nations schooling be named after her. And people want to learn more about this. There's an extraordinary documentary film called Hi Ho Mistahe that Alanis Obomsawin made for the National Film Board. And it's been screened by Amnesty members across the country many times. And I believe it's still available to be seen online as well.
So one study indicates that funding for First Nations schools has fallen behind other schools by around $1 billion since 2005. Can you speak to that? Why do you think that is?
Yeah, and it's not just it's schools, but it's so many other aspects of life for children and First Nations leaders. And to understand that, we have to take a step back and understand how the funding has worked. Because of the division of powers between the federal and the provincial government, services that for most people in Canada are provided to provincial governments, on reserve, they're provided to the federal government, often in relation to Indian Act responsibilities. So that while other public schools, for example, in Saskatchewan, the funding arrangements are through the provincial government, if that school is on a reserve, then the funding is through the federal government. In many cases, the standards are provincially set, but the funding formula is a federal responsibility. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, Shannon was from Attawapiskat, and Attawapiskat was in the news a couple of years ago because of a housing crisis. And the government at the time, you know, defended itself by talking about the millions of dollars that the government has spent in Attawapiskat. And we hear this all the time, all the money the federal government spent in First Nations reserves. And that money is always out of context. It's never compared to the money that is spent for services for people in other communities. And when we compare it, there is consistently a difference. There's consistently federal underfunding. So if you just have to compare the per-person spending, whether it's on something like on-reserve education or on something like child and family services, less money is being spent. But that's only half the story. The rest of the story is that that lower funding is being provided in a context in which the needs are greater. And I think that the most crucial part of the context here, and we're going to come later in the conversation to talk about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but it's worth saying up front that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission found that Canada's policies toward First Nations expressed through the residential schools, but not just the residential schools, the whole array of policies were a systematic program of cultural genocide meant to eradicate the distinct cultural identity of Indigenous people. This is the legacy in which all of this, you know, this funding now operates. The legacy of that violation in its seriousness, its severity, its intensity, creates greater needs in so many areas, including in education, including in child and family services. The needs are higher precisely as a consequence of terrible crimes committed against First Nations by the government of Canada in the name of all Canadians. So there's this enormous need, and addressing that need is a fundamental issue of justice. So the third factor is that you have less funding, you have greater needs, you also simply have higher costs. The cost of delivering services in communities that are generally much smaller, in communities that may be more remote, particularly we're talking, say, flying communities, the costs are simply higher. So when we say that the 25% or 30% funding shortfall, that is significant, as we now know conclusively from the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruling we're also going to talk about, that it is contrary to Canada's anti-discrimination laws. But it's also only half the story, because the real issue is enough funding being provided to meet the real needs of First Nations children, to provide them equal opportunity in life as was enjoyed by all other kids across Canada? And as to why this is the case, I mean, the only answer, when this is a problem that has been known for years, been known for decades, the harm has clearly been known. There's been any number of releases of government documents that show that internal conversations within government ministries directly link this underfunding to horrendous consequences, terrible outcomes in education, in health, issues such as suicide. We know that there's a link, is known and understood. The only possible reason for it to continue year after year is racism and discrimination.
So last year, the federal government promised to increase funding for First Nations schools, but added a proviso. They wanted the First Nations leaders to support plans for a new law on education. However, the proposed law failed to address many key issues in First Nations education, including the teaching of Indigenous languages. And that was something that was lost, the culture, language, the spiritualism of First Nations people through colonialism. How can the government promise increased funding and then add a proviso?
And I mean, you're exactly right. And there's so many issues there. And language is a crucial one. And we work with activists whose primary focus is the preservation and revitalization of Indigenous languages. And they always point out the incredible uphill struggles they face because of the harms that have been done in the past. And they'll look and say, look how much money is provided to strengthen and support the official languages in Canada, and look how little is provided for all of the First Nations languages, for Métis, the Métis language, for the Inuit language. The disparity is profound, and again, is despite the need. So the lack of funding for First Nations languages was one of the crucial issues. We step back a moment. The First Nations education legislation that was being offered by the federal government was consistent with a pattern under the previous government, in which, in response to areas where there was harm being done by underfunding, the federal government response was not to deal with the funding first, as a first priority, but the first priority to introduce new legislation to give the government greater power. So, for example, they also introduced and successfully passed what they called a Clean Water for First Nations Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. And that act didn't provide any more funding, but what it did do is provide greater power for the federal government over First Nations in relation to drinking water. So the first issue always seemed to be, the first priority always seemed to be to increase the already incredible amount of control that the federal government exerts over Indigenous people's lives, particularly for First Nations on reserve through the Indian Act. And then, the funding would then, in the case of the Education Act, the funding was tied to First Nations acceptance and support of the Act. And there's a really uncomfortable parallel there to an act of ransom, of holding people hostage, of saying, we know and acknowledge that you're suffering terrible hardships because of underfunding, but before we address that injustice, you have to agree to new conditions from us. You have to agree to more things that we want from you. That's just been a clearly an unacceptable approach. It's an antagonistic approach, and it's an approach which fails in the most basic duty of all governments, which is to put the best interests of children first.
Exactly, and this is historically the way it's been since the Indian Act and since the since all the acts right from the 1700s. This is just a continuation of the way it's been right from the start when the settlers came and took over the land. Craig, you contributed to the book Indivisible, which examines crucial issues for human rights of Indigenous peoples in Canada and around the world. How has your chapter called Free, Prior, and Informed Consent contributed to the success of campaigns in defense of human rights of Indigenous peoples in Canada?
Thank you for bringing that book up. I was edited by Joyce Green, and I think it's a great resource. It was a response to the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And just as you said, my contribution to it was to focus on an issue that we deal with all the time, and it goes an issue that goes right to the heart of this question of who gets to make decisions about the future and about the well-being of Indigenous communities. International law has a framework called Free, Prior, and Informed Consent, and it rests on two foundations. One of the foundations is the foundation of self-determination, that Indigenous people, like all other people, have the right to make their own decisions. And that's basic. And when you look at core international human rights instruments, things like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights or the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, pillars of the UN human rights system, the very first article is a recognition of the right of all people to self-determination. So it's fundamental. The other, overlapping foundation of support is the notion that Indigenous peoples are the ones best place to make their own decisions. We have seen, and the residential schools is a shocking and profound example of this, that decisions imposed upon Indigenous peoples by settler governments, whether those are decisions that are framed in offensive, harmful, racist doctrines, or whether they are framed in the claim to know what's best for Indigenous people, have had the impact of imposing terrible harm. And what international human rights law says, the best way to prevent this kind of harm in the situation of a historic disadvantage, historic impoverishment and marginalization, is to make sure the decision-making power is in the hands of the people who know what's best for themselves, for their families, for their communities. And the concept is that, therefore, is one of free, prior, informed consent. And it has a direct parallel in something that all of us know quite intimately, which is if you go into a hospital for any kind of procedure, you need to sign a consent form, because ultimately the decision about your health, your body, has to be made by you, not by doctors, not by a hospital board, not by a medical establishment. There's a parallel to the concept of free, prior, informed consent for Indigenous people. Free, prior, informed consent runs through the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was adopted by the United Nations back in 2007. But it's there in that declaration because it had already been so well established in international law. And it comes out and applies particularly, and it becomes an issue of particular concern around resource development decisions, which is where we work on it a lot. But it would also apply around things like, you know, healthcare, like education, especially languages, around issues of child and family services. The fundamental principles there. And unfortunately, what we have experienced has been that governments in Canada have not wanted to give up exactly that kind of power that you described, that power that they have exercised for 100 years or more over the lives of Indigenous people. They are so reluctant to give up that power that the previous federal government, many provincial governments, have fought very, very hard against acknowledgement of the right of free, prior, informed consent, even though there's so many precedents in Canada for it, from the history of treaty making itself to the Royal Proclamation to important Supreme Court decisions like Dalgamuth and Haida, which also affirm the principle of consent. You know, it's not foreign to the rule of law in Canada by any means, but the resistance has been deep and fierce, and it has been a real struggle for Indigenous peoples to get free, prior, informed consent on the negotiating table, to get it in the court. But fortunately, having said all of that, I think the tide is turning. We see the federal government, we see the government of Alberta, both publicly making commitments toward free, prior, informed consent. We see major players in the resource industry making commitments to free, prior, informed consent, at least in principle. We have the historic Socotian Supreme Court decision, which really put a lot of substance to the concept of consent in Canadian law. We've had a significant environmental impact assessment panel really set out free, prior, consent as a crucial decision-making factor for that panel. And we have real momentum on the international stage as well. So I think that the fight against free, prior, informed consent that the previous federal government had led for 10 years was a losing fight, and the tide of history has swept on now.
So the tide is starting to turn.
It genuinely is, and I don't think I say that out of any foolish optimism. I quite genuinely believe that. And in the chapter that I contributed to Joyce Green's book, I told the extraordinary story of the Grassy Narrows First Nation in northwestern Ontario near the Manitoba border. And that First Nation has been consistent year after year after year saying that logging will only take place in their territory with their consent, and they don't give that consent. And the striking thing is, although the government of Ontario has never acknowledged that right of consent, the people of Grassy Narrows actually had a breakthrough with a major player in the international forest industry, in which the company that at the long end of supply was buying the pulp from logged at Grassy Narrows and turning to paper for sale in U.S. and Canadian markets, looked at the evidence and said they accept that the community is right to insist on consent because of all the harm they've experienced in history and because of the harm that this logging could cause to them. And that paper company, it was a Boise Cascade, I think it's called Boise now, said they didn't want to handle wood and wood products from Grassy Narrows until that consent had been given. And when they took that principled stand, it brought logging at Grassy Narrows to a halt. I think it's an extraordinary story of the power that community had to stick to their rights, to stick to their principles, and the fact that they could win recognition and win enforcement of their rights even without the cooperation of the provincial government. And again, it's another example of where in many ways governments are being dragged along behind progressive movements within broader society.
Thanks very much, Craig. You're listening to Human Rights Radio, and we're listening to Craig Benjamin from the Ottawa office of Amnesty International Canada. And I'm Jim Hutchings with Gord Barnes and Daylene Sliss. And we're going to be taking a break, but first of all, we have to mention our serious fundraiser here for CJTR. And once a year, we have our Look and Listen Lottery, and the time has come And I want to tell you about what we've got in the way of prizes. And the tickets this year are, as last year, they're $20. But this time, we have a choice of your grand prize. Instead of one location, you pick your own location from a choice of four. We can go to Cleveland, Ohio, to Nashville, Tennessee, to New Orleans, Louisiana, and Las Vegas, Nevada. So there's lots of interesting things there that are included. They're all seven-night stays. And in Cleveland, you can go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Polka Hall of Fame, Christmas Storyhouse Tour. Nashville, of course, you've got Nashville. You got two tickets to the Grand Ole Opry and the seven-night stay. New Orleans, you've got the seven-night stay and the Super City Tour and the Swamp and Bayou Tour. And Las Vegas, once again, seven-night stay. You've got the Grand Canyon South Rim VIP Tour and tickets to La Rev. The second prize is a $1,000 travel voucher from Carlson Wagenli Rickert Travel. And third prize is the Regina Folk Festival 2016 Experience. Two weekend passes to Regina Folk Festival 2016. Now, we're only selling 1,500 of these tickets. Draw date is May 13th. So the last day we'll be selling tickets is May 12th. So make sure you don't miss out. You can get tickets here at CJTR's offices at 1102 8th Avenue or by calling the radio station at 306-525-7274 during regular office hours Monday through Friday. If you want to pay by credit card, you can order tickets at over the phone, actually, during regular office hours. And you can order tickets also at by email at lookandlistenlottery@cjtr.ca. And you can find all the rules of play and more information about the prizes at cjtr.ca. Tickets are only for sale in Saskatchewan. And you must be over 18 years of age and older to participate. So I could definitely buy a ticket. But unfortunately, I can't win because I work here. That's terrible. The lottery will be drawn on May 13th at 5 p.m. on the air. This is an important fundraiser for CJTR, and we encourage you to take part and hopefully one of our listeners. I would like it if one of our CJTR Human Rights Radio listeners was one of the winners. So with that, we're going to take a station break, and when we come out of that, we're going to hear some Joni Mitchell. Called the item is called The Circle Game. So we'll be right back with some music, and then we'll come back and talk with Craig Benjamin. So we will be right back.
Yesterday, a child came out to wonder. turn to car wheels through the town. And they tell him, take your time, it won't be long now, till you drag your feet too slow, the circle's down. And the seasons, they go round. On the carousel of time, we can't return, we can only look behind from where we came, and go round and round and round in the circle game. So the years spin by, and now the boy is 20. Lost some grandeur coming true. There'll be new dreams, maybe better dreams, and plenty before the last revolving year is through. And the seasons, they go. We can only look behind from where we came and go round and round and round in the circle game. And go round and round and round in the circle game.
That is Joni Mitchell. You gotta love Joni for sure, don't you?
That's a classic.
Yeah. Anyway, we're carrying on our conversation here. I'm Jim Hutchings with Daylene.
Oh, Jim.
I was doing so well. Daylene Sliss. And Gord Barnes. And we're talking with Craig Benjamin. Oh, Craig, don't make the mistakes that I make.
So if you're just joining us, we are pleased to have on Human Rights Radio this Friday, April 8th, Craig Benjamin out of Ottawa, who is the campaigner for human rights of Indigenous peoples. And I guess for this half hour, we're going to be discussing the Jordan Principle and a little bit more discussion on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Craig, if you would like to continue the discussion, on we go.
There's one other thing, if I can just mention. I'd be kind of interested in Craig updating us on is it sort of flows as well from the first half hour discussion. And I'm not clear. Does the government of the federal government now have to go back to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal and report on what its plans are to implement? You know
what Gord's referring to is a decision that came down in January of this year from the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal on the crucial issue of federal discrimination against First Nations children on reserve and in the Yukon because of that systematic underfunding of children's services that we talked about in the first half hour. And I mentioned Cindy Blackstock and her work around Shannon's Dream campaign. Well, Cindy Blackstock and the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, they first brought this complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal in 2007. So it took all that time for the decision to finally come out. So it took a full 9 years. And the decision is historic because it states utterly conclusively that there is an obligation not just to provide equal funding, but to provide funding that meets the real needs of First Nations children. I actually have the wording in front of me as part of the decision, and I think it's really important. It says that substantive equality and Canada's international obligations, here it's referring to the international human rights system as well as the Canadian Human Rights Act, requires that First Nations children on reserve be provided child and family services of comparable quality and accessibility as those provided to all Canadians off reserve, including that they be sufficiently funded to meet the real needs of First Nations children and families and do not perpetuate historical disadvantage. Now, the ruling is binding, and the tribunal called for immediate measures to end the discrimination and also set in motion a process where it would work and oversee a dialogue between the Child and Family Caring Society, the Assembly of First Nations, the federal government, over what are the long-term solutions needed to put in place to address this issue. And all of this happened, you know, in the early days of the new government, and part of the government's reply is to say that it would be taking measures in the budget that just came out recently. And unfortunately, we did not see in that budget nearly sufficient action to address the problems that were highlighted by the tribunal or their seriousness. So we can assume that this will be the subject of considerable attention within the process that the tribunal is overseeing. But we're not off to a good start, unfortunately.
So will the federal government have to, in that sense, report to the tribunal about what its plans are, and then Cindy
sorry,
Blackstock?
Gordon, I'm not hearing you very clearly.
Okay. Sorry. Craig, I'm wondering, does the federal government have to sort of formally report now to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal? And, you know, Cindy Blackstock has the opportunity with her organization to provide the her comments as well?
The process is actually better than that, in a sense, because the tribunal is playing a very hands-on role. It what it did is it reserved jurisdiction and established a process where it would directly oversee. So there is both an exchange of written commentary, but there will also, we understand, there will be a face-to-face process is imagined as part of this.
Great. Thank you.
But maybe just to follow up for a moment on the budget issue, because I think this is something that's important to take apart a little bit. The last federal government got a lot of attention because there was unprecedented funding commitments to services for First Nations, and you know, on the face of it, that's welcome. The trouble is when you start breaking down how that works out. So, in terms of the funding specific for child and family services on reserve, the initial funding commitment is actually still far less than what the federal government itself acknowledged back in 2012 would be necessary to provide a comparable level of service to First Nations children on reserve compared to other children. So what they're offering to provide this year falls far short of what they themselves had acknowledged 5 years ago was necessary to have the most bare minimum form of equity, never mind actually starting to address that historic disadvantage identified by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. In fact, according to the federal government budget, it will be 3 years before the funding levels reach that point that the government itself acknowledged was what was needed. Now, that was the government's acknowledgement, which again falls far short of what, for example, the Child and Family Caring Society has said is necessary. The Caring Society itself actually called for an immediate $200 million in relief to fulfill the ruling of the tribunal that in addition to long-term measures, there be immediate relief for the discrimination experienced by First Nations children. Federal funding falls almost $130 million short of what the Caring Society felt was needed. And I've got to say, the Caring Society, over this long process, they have been the single most reliable voice in estimating need in assessing the reality of government budgeting.
So Daylene was mentioning the question of the sort of where we're at now in terms of the Jordan Principle discussion and that whole area, and maybe you could take a few minutes and update us on that, Craig.
Yeah, Jordan's principle is another important piece of the total picture. Jordan's principle is another one of the focuses of campaigning by the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. The Jordan's principle builds on the basic idea that the best interests of the child come first. And it takes it a step further in relation to that complex relationship between the federal and provincial governments when it comes to services to First Nations. Far too often, services for First Nations children are needlessly delayed because of squabbling between levels of government over who should pay for what. If, for example, a child's parents are resident on reserve, the services they need aren't available on reserve. They can only be provided for in a provincial hospital in the nearest urban center. Who pays the bill? Who pays for what kind of service? What if the province allows for a certain kind of service, the federal government doesn't allow for that kind of service? How is that worked out? And the principle is named in memory of a child. Jordan River Anderson, he's from the Norway House Cree Nation in Manitoba, and he spent more than 2 years in a hospital because of, and eventually passed away in hospital at a very young age of a serious illness that was incurable. But the point was that he could have spent that time at home with his family if family had received the home care supports available to other children, and they weren't provided because of a dispute between the federal and provincial governments over who should pay. Jordan's principle says that should never happen. Jordan's principle says meet the best interest of the child first, resolve the disputes between levels of jurisdiction, however you need to resolve them, but don't let those disputes stand in the way of children getting the services they need. Jordan's principle is supported by unanimous bill passed in the Federal House of Commons. All of the provinces and territories support Jordan's principle. The trouble has been, like so often is the case where they support something principle, there has been a failure to implement it comprehensively and across the board.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically...
I was going to say, it's basically...
You know, too many areas, those same kinds of disputes continue to deny... First Nations children, First Nations people with disabilities, and others access to services that they need.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, Craig, it's basically it's law in Manitoba, but nowhere else. Mm. Is that the case?
Well, it's law for the federal government because of the bill that they passed. But it was a bill that was at the level of principle rather than of firm implementation measures, and we have seen resistance to implementation in specific cases.
This brings me to a quote out of the executive summary of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They emphasize that Canadians must do more than just talk about reconciliation. We must learn how to practice reconciliation in our everyday lives, within ourselves and our families and in our communities, governments, places of worship, schools, and workplaces. Craig, can you comment on this? How can people practice this in our everyday lives? What can we do as volunteers of Amnesty International, as regular citizens? How can we make this work?
Yeah, that's such an important point. I think it goes back to the first thing that I said, is that we all need, that for non-Aboriginal communities, we all have to acknowledge that we're on a learning path. We have to be honest about the fact that we have grown up in a society that has been shaped by systemic racism that long predates us, but that did affect our own lives. It did affect the education we received. It did affect the values and attitudes that we learn growing up. And you cannot be complacent about this. You cannot simply assume because you're a good person, because you're a well-intentioned person, that you're going to do the right thing. There needs to be an active learning process, one which confronts those biases, those assumptions, one that actually delves into our history. And, you know, and I think there's probably no better place to begin with that than with the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission itself. And you know, it really reckons, and we have the advantage of having that report. We have the advantage of having the report now of the Human Rights Tribunal on the child welfare case. We have the advantage of having things like the World Commission on Aboriginal Peoples or the Saskatchewan Commission on First Nations and Métis Justice. We have so many good learning tools available to us, and we need to take advantage of those. We need to be brave or not afraid to bring them into our own lives and to talk about them and to confront racist attitudes around us. I'd also say that there's a concrete program of action in front of us. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission said that the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples is the framework for reconciliation. We don't need to reinvent a new framework, but there was a long and lengthy process which Indigenous peoples around the world, and especially Indigenous activists, leaders, academics, grassroots folks from across Canada, participated actively, and they shaped a framework that is an anti-racist framework. It is an anti-colonial framework. It is a framework based, as the Declaration said, on recognizing the minimum standards for the survival, dignity, and well-being of Indigenous people. It is a framework for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people to work together for the purpose of fulfilling everyone's rights. The framework is there, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission said that and commended it to our youth. And I think that means a number of things, including pushing our governments, federal and provincial, to take the Declaration seriously, to make sure that federal and provincial and territorial bureaucrats know the Declaration, to make sure that they acknowledge their obligations under the Declaration and stand up for and defend those obligations, and engage in an active dialogue about what it means with Indigenous peoples' organizations, not only at the national level, but right down to the level of specific nations and the level of important service providers, like, say, the Regina Treaty Society or the Friendship Center. You know, really engage on that basis. And I think other institutions need to do the same. And I think I'll give the example that I think is particularly important. Our learning institutions, our universities and colleges, they have human rights frameworks themselves. They have adopted human rights frameworks. They need to also, as part of that, adopt the UN Declaration as part of their own guiding principles and frameworks, and look seriously at how they then apply it in terms of curriculum, in terms of student support, in terms of the climate and atmosphere of learning that they want to facilitate on campus.
Craig, we don't have a lot of time left, but one area that we haven't had a discussion about is the work on the federal government is now moving forward relative to the murdered and missing Indigenous women and the plan for an inquiry. But I'm really, given we don't have a lot of time, sort of interested in the comment you made the other day on Twitter, I think it was, where there are things that could be done and need to be done even in advance of the inquiry. And maybe you could speak to that in the few minutes that we've got left.
This is so important. The inquiry is such an important process. The subject it's dealing with is complex. The families, the affected communities, and individuals need to be treated with dignity and respect and supported and provided a safe place to tell their stories. And those stories need to be heard with respect. This can't be rushed. This needs to take time. But action can't be delayed. And we already know so many things that can and should and must be done to increase the safety and well-being of Indigenous women. Whether this is closing the gap in funding for basic services, things like culturally appropriate and sensitive shelters and other services for women, for example, whether it includes a real plan of action to address systemic racism in policing, measures to ensure proper police response and protocols to missing persons, the basic fundamental of finally in Canada getting to the point where we accurately acknowledge and report on and talk about the rates of violence faced by Indigenous women. There's so many things that can be done right away and can and need and should be done. And we've had past studies, we've had past parliamentary committees. We've had work of organizations like the Native Women's Association of Canada. We've had two really profoundly important reports by international human rights bodies that dug into the issue of violence against Indigenous women in Canada, the Inter-American Commission and the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. They have bodies of recommendations that need to be acted on. The past recommendations of previous inquiries like the Saskatchewan Justice Commission need to be acted on. And that's so important. And I'll say, if I can say one other thing very quickly about the inquiry process, it is also crucial that the inquiry not be limited to federal jurisdiction, that the factors putting Indigenous women's lives at risk and denying Indigenous women the safety, protection, support that they need and deserve are not only federal, they're federal, provincial, and territorial. And we continue to look for the concrete commitment from the provinces and territories that they will genuinely participate in this process and open up their jurisdictions, open up their governments, open up their officials to be examined in a very real and meaningful way by this inquiry.
So are you saying that in the provinces, in some cases, are not on side with respect to that?
They're all on side in saying there needs to be inquiry. We have yet to see the concrete commitment. It's our best analysis is that they cannot passively simply step back and let this happen. They need to take action at the provincial level to give the inquiry the power and authority to subpoena witnesses and to demand release of documents that relate to provincial jurisdiction or territorial jurisdiction.
I just one question, Craig. Do you think it's helping that we now have a justice minister who is an Indigenous woman, no less? Is that affecting things?
I mean, it no doubt helps. It helps also. It's important that she comes from a background where she knows very well and has spoken out on some of the fundamental principles that are at stake, whether it's in the inquiry or other aspects of the relationship between the federal government and Indigenous peoples. And I think there was a powerful signal that's being sent. At the same time, the scope of her office, her range of responsibilities is enormous, and very clearly is not in any way limited to the rights of Indigenous people.
And with that, Craig, I think we are done. We'd like to thank you very much for being on our show with us today.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you. All the best.
Okay. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."